Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber, welcome. Hope you're having a great day. You look amazing. I have a feeling you're going to have an amazing day today. You see what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts. You get a bonus greeting on every episode. So hit that subscribe button. I am here today with Rupert Avelle. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
That's good. Yeah.
That's one good and done. Perfect. How you doing, man?
I'm good. Thank you. And you?
Good. We're coming. You're coming at us from beautiful, balmy Singapore, huh?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. It's a long way away from where you guys are, but very familiar in many ways, I imagine.
Yeah. How did you, what brought you out there? What was that catalyst for you to make that move?
It was work. I had an interest in the Asia Pacific region for a long time, and I'd been trying to learn some of the languages when I was based in the UK. And then there was an opportunity, an internal vacancy where I was working at the time. I applied, I got it. I would love to say there was a lot more forethought behind it, but there wasn't. It was just, I'd done a few international moves before, and you just kind of got to jump at them when you get the opportunity and then work out the how you're going to sort of survive after that. So Singapore is a very easy place to live though, but this region is fascinating. And it's been over 10 years now, so.
Oh, you've been in Singapore for 10 years?
Yeah. I moved in 2010, so.
Oh, wow, okay.
So mid-year it'll be about 11 years.
Wow, that's amazing. So what has been the biggest change out there? What's been the biggest thing to adjust to?
Oh, for me personally, just the weather. I mean, the honestly, like different cultures and stuff, I actually find sort of stimulating and energizing. I was in London before. I'm not a city boy, but I lived there for 8-10 years, and the pace of life there is probably similar to a lot of your cities. People move quick, they walk quick, it's hustle and bustle. So when I moved here, I sort of adopted the same mentality, but if you walk and move around quick in this climate, you melt. And so it was just sort of adjusting to not being the horrible, like sweaty white guy in every meeting. So that was the main adjustment.
That was the big one.
And it's a work in progress.
Work in progress. Each day we get a little better and get to stay a little drier.
Exactly.
So why don't we just kind of start at the beginning? So you're somebody that I met on LinkedIn. I've been following for a while. We have mutual friend, Kevin, who kind of put us in touch. And I'd love to hear kind of what your focus is, what area of the compliance and ethics game you focus on, and kind of how did you get into this game? Because I'm sure when you were growing up in the UK, you probably weren't dreaming of being in the compliance field.
No, I didn't really even know it existed, to be honest. Now, when I was graduating, a lot of the people I was graduating with were going into, I guess, what you call like, classic kind of business careers, like maybe management consulting or accounting firms, big MNCs, that type of stuff. And I didn't really know where would best suit me. And I saw a job that was related to kind of risk, and particularly the focus on political risk and counterterrorism. I thought that sounds interesting. And so I applied for that. I got that. I did that for a few years, and it was a lot of fun. But fun's maybe the wrong word, because it was I started that job in 2001, so it was a kind of intense time to be working in that sector. But it was certainly stimulating. And then I was lucky. There was a mentor who was my line manager who sort of said to me, "Because you're going to hit a ceiling in this world, you might want to think about a sort of a lateral move sooner rather than later." And there's a lot of at that time, there was a kind of a boom in the investigative world, partly driven by the start of, the very nascent bit of regulation. So mainly AML, some anti-bribery stuff. So we're talking about like early to mid 2000s. So I made some contacts in the various risk consulting firms and ended up eventually getting a role in control risks in London, doing investigative work. And from there, I sort of did a number of internal jumps that then brought me to Singapore. And my remit when I came to Singapore was to establish a kind of a network of assets, if you want, of people to gather information for us and feed us information on the investigations we are conducting. Because outside of Singapore, particularly in Southeast Asia, there's not a whole lot of it's changing, but the law enforcement environment is patchy, is the best way to say it. So you have to rely on other forms of information, and the public domain is either very controlled if you're talking about somewhere like Vietnam, or it's unreliable if you may be talking about sort of Thailand, Philippines sometimes. So there, I started just sort of falling in love with the region, and then over time it was more the clients that were that dictated my career, because it became, well, we can keep investigating, we can keep responding to crises, and there was a lot of crisis management. There's a lot of sometimes people trying to do the right thing. We're getting shaken down by some corrupt politician, we're refusing to pay, they're now frustrating our operation, there's goons at the gate, our people have been detained, some really thorny problems.
Yeah.
And from that, I moved more into the preventative side, and was asked to sort of set up control risk ethics and compliance consulting function. And a couple of years ago, I decided to sort of do it by founding my own company. And the sort of motivation for that was manifold. But one of the things I wanted to experiment and understand is if technology could be brought to sort of democratize some of this advice, because I found that a lot of it was very similar. A lot of people in different industries, different sectors are having the same problems. And it's quite hard sometimes for them to know what everyone else is doing. You have concerns over sharing of confidential information. You have concerns over privacy and anti-competitive practices, all the usual stuff. So can technology be brought to solve two areas that seem to be a challenge for people? Risk assessments, basically knowing where to start and what their potential exposure was in this burgeoning area of ethics and compliance across multinational businesses. And the second area was getting good, effective guidance, because a lot of the guidance I found, I saw was a bit hard for people to action, particularly in this region. So they have edicts that come in sort of 50-page documents from headquarters in the States and Europe, and then they're told, right, you in Indonesia implement this and we have zero tolerance on facilitation payments. And they're like, okay, well, firstly, I don't understand what facilitation payment is. Secondly, I can't read half of this policy. So that was the driver to where I am now. But honestly, it's changing every day, and people like Kevin and you and others kind of stimulate thought. And the area that sort of I'm being pulled into most at the moment is, for want of a better word, trying to make the advice and support clear, concise, and compelling.
So that's kind of a challenge, right? Because you're talking about a bunch of different jurisdictions, a bunch of different languages, a bunch of different sort of like country cultures. How do they digest this stuff? How do you translate it into their words, not like literally, but also figuratively? Mm. How do you democratize that? And how do you leverage this technology to hit that sort of second sort of prong of the fork, right? The first one's kind of this risk assessment. The other was kind of democratizing that. How do you utilize that technology to help bridge that gap?
Well, the risk assessment seemed to me critical, because the kind of the what you're doing, who you're doing it with, where you're doing it with it, particularly within a sub-region, has such a massive impact. And at the moment, the people will use indices, and those indices are fantastic. But if I give you one example, say Transparency International, Malaysia ranks like around 50, something like that. And that's an aggregate scoring, and that's probably a fair reflection. If you're, I don't know, a software company or a professional services firm in Kuala Lumpur, that's probably a fairly, you can live with that rating. If you're involved in hydropower in Borneo, or like car manufacturing in Johor Bahru in the south of the country, the risk picture is very different in terms of, in the former, you're going to be dealing with government interference, with human rights issues, with land clearance, with ground corruption. In the latter, you're going to be dealing with petty frauds, etc. And so having a simplified approach to risk assessment that actually tells an organization, because a lot of the people I'm working with, they're not always like, you know, the Fortune 500, Fortune 100. They're people who know they need this stuff, but they don't always have the same access that some of those massive organizations have. So the biggest question is, where do I start and what's actually relevant to me? So is modern slavery relevant to me? Is, you know, what elements of anti-bribery, where am I actually going to interface with these touch points, and what do I do about it? So the risk assessment bit, by asking better questions and asking granular questions, so on a Likert scale as opposed to binary, just makes it simple. Because I found a lot of stuff is, do you have this? Do you have that? That doesn't really help. Do you have do you conduct training? Yeah, we conduct training. That doesn't help much. A better bunch of questions might be, well, what is the frequency? What is the level of understanding? Is it tested? What is the completion? You know, so you start to just, and that can all be automated. And you have a much better idea of where the internal gaps are, and meeting that external environment. And to your second point about the democratizing, I'm learning every day as I go, but I think stories are probably one of the major keys, the emotions. So a lot of the literature that comes out of social media and sales is actually quite helpful. Like, you know, if you think about what makes things go viral, what makes people share them, it's exactly that logic. So it's trying to work out how we can do that. So it sort of triggers a response to people. So having the prompt where the issue occurs. So I'm working with a client at the moment, and it's coming up to the Lunar New Year celebrations here in Asia. And so they're starting the triggers for guidance around that. That's perfect. But then it also needs to be in a format that is memorable and maybe sort of captures some emotional resonance. So it's those type of areas I'm looking into more now.
Yeah, and that's got to be hard to sort of bridge, right? Because we're talking again about different cultures, and you know, what's going to be resonant for one might not be resonant for another. I remember this. There's this show in the States called Everybody Loves Raymond, and they tried to push it out to other countries, and it was really interesting the changes that they had to make to sort of the base dynamics of the show for it to play really well in Russia, for example. And so when we're talking about like compliance stories, if they're going to have that sort of emotional resonance, and if it's going to actually prompt behavior, to your point, it's got to hit the brain, right? The brain has to understand it, but it also has to hit the heart if some actual new action or some new behaviors are going to, you know, be prompted, to your point. It's not an easy challenge by any means.
No, but technology helps a lot because you can start to crowdsource. So the as you just pointed out, the knowledge sits within people's heads. And I think one thing that gets forgotten in a lot of organizations is this isn't anyone's first rodeo. Unless it's a graduate, most people have worked at other places. They, even if you haven't come across that issue in your organization yet, someone in your organization probably has at some juncture in their career. Yeah. And teasing those stories out making those stories relevant to that client is absolutely crucial. Because for example, when I'm doing training, you always get the feedback forms, and the number one thing that people will gravitate towards in the thing they like most is stories from within their business, because it gets all of the triggers, it's relevant, yeah. It gets engagement. So it's just, I guess it's finding that there are certain themes and trends which it's useful to have, you know, to build up a knowledge base of, and that's what I'm working at the moment. But everything will need, as you say, that tweaking and adapting to live properly in a different organization in a different culture.
So when, let's say you're coming in to an organization and they don't have anything. Mm-hmm. Your first step is to do some kind of a risk assessment. Yeah. And then you go from where, like, how do you not end up playing whack-a-mole and saying, well, I have to do everything now?
There's a live example, which is you know, the FCPA guidance, you have 6 months post acquisition to, you know, to tidy up the acquired company. Yeah. So I'm working with an organization that's just in that process, and they're kind of passing on that post acquisition integration bit to me and some other guys I'm working with. And the risk assessment can be done very, very quickly. And we've got a lot better at it I think everyone has by being forced to with the pandemic. So there's tools out there like Mural, where you can kind of collaborate and you can do all the post-it note stuff that we once did in person. Mm-hmm. And so if you just ask people from across the business simple questions around where, you know, on a scale of likelihood from negligible or, you know, very unlikely through to almost certain, and on a scale of impact from whatever you choose, severe through to negligible, who would the demand come from, or the pressure or the issue, what would it look like, and then just rate it. And then you can quickly start to see that very few things sit in that top right quadrant generally for most businaces that are acute. There's very few things
that's
that are
highly impact likely, and
highly exactly. Okay. And so the those few places is where you start. And there'll often be some debate around that internally as well, around likelihood. The one thing I find really interesting in this region is, and I guess it's also true in a lot of emerging markets, and it's not talked about enough in my view, is that there's, we're now moving into the impact of saying no. So corruption is a classic example. So, you know, if I give an actual example. So there was, I worked with a client in India. They have a big terminal at a port, and the authorities are trying to shake them down under sort of fairly spurious pretenses about zoning regulations, and they shouldn't be doing this and that. And so they threatened, tried to extort this payment out of the most senior guy on site. He refused to pay, and he was detained. He was shoved in jail, essentially. And that's not an uncommon threat. So the threats may come at the end of a barrel. They may come implicitly or towards your family. But I don't think it's talked about enough that you have a lot of frontline people who have to deal with quite unpleasant extortion on a daily basis. So just saying, well, this is the corruption risk in this country, and we're likely to encounter those issues, is not enough. You've got to go that step further and go, well, what is the impact when we say no? And what is our contingency for that? And how do we work around that? How are we going to support our people? And that's a kind of a passion area.
That changes that matrix you just described to really more of a cube, because
exactly
you're going to be encountered with it, but then what are we going to do about it? And how are we going to deal with it? You said that's a passion area for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I moved to this area, I was very cognizant that I'm living in other people's country and culture. And there's a lot of expats, as they're called in Singapore, foreigners who don't, from what I can see, necessarily show a huge amount of respect for the local culture. They kind of treat it like a sunshine posting for a while. And so there is a level of enmity in parts of this region towards sort of, and it's also got the colonial overlays. And so I was very conscious of that, maybe too much so. And I was nervous about, you know, coming across as this preachy foreigner telling people in their own country how they should behave. And one of the things that really helped dissipate that was I did for this one client, we did a kind of roadshow of workshops around pretty much every country in the region. And in every country, there was some expats who, as soon as we came in and started talking about this stuff, they sat back, they folded their arms, and they were like, yeah, here you go. And you got the usual stuff you hear often. It's always been done this way, or you don't understand this country, da, da, da. And it was the locals who would, and I remember one lady particularly, this is the finance manager in the Philippines business, and she stood up and just banged her hand on the table, and she said, you don't get it. I have to bribe to get my son in to see a doctor. I have to bribe to be allowed to drive down the street. I have to bribe for my teacher to properly grade my son's paper. You're coming here to get rich in my country because there's economic opportunity. The least you can do is bring some better standards of governance. And I started to realize and hear this story repeated endlessly that these folks, these frontline people who are, you know, living in these countries, and we fly and we fly out, and we may not be here forever, who have to deal with this in ways that we cannot possibly understand. And I traveled through some really messed up countries, like places like Cambodia, you know, where you have a failed state, essentially. And I've done in-depth money laundering investigations. You've got every kind of horrible organized criminal outfit you can imagine in those countries. You have excruciating, grinding poverty. And I've seen the levers of government, and it's very politically driven. So Cambodia is sort of sitting between China and America and US policy. So you have these messy situations where what I'm saying essentially is you have intractable government malaise that is not going to drive the necessary change. Money talks. People investing in those countries and operating in those countries have a much better chance to create impact. And that's where I get, as you can probably tell, where my emotion and my blood rises is when you have the opportunity to affect in a very small, small way some positive change in a country that dearly needs it and the people who deserve better, because everyone deserves better from their leaders.
So, I mean, I guess what you're kind of saying is that it's sort of incumbent, or I don't know if incumbent's the right word, but there's at least an opportunity for businesses who may have more sway to help bring some of this governance that can drive the change toward a more sort of moralistic or more sort of compliant society. And largely though, do you see organizations, like, where do they fall on the spectrum? Is it just all over the place?
That one has always fascinated me. It's I would struggle to give you any kind of cogent analysis of trends, but often I would just say, be prepared to be surprised. Like, I remember to give two examples, I remember working for one organization that's a charity that as a kid I gave like some of the money I'd earn as pocket money to, because they save animals and that meant a lot to me. And I remember them just behaving really badly and flying around in private jets on basic junkets at taxpayers' expense in very yeah. poor countries. And I remember thinking, okay, that's really, you know, the scales fell from my eyes. And then I've also worked with, you know, oil and gas sector clients who are in the midst of regulatory actions where the people inside are just passionate about making, you know, the anti-fraud, anti-corruption, whatever you want to call it, better. So it's highly counterintuitive. But I think generally I'm positive because there's a recognition, and it's not just a Western-led one. So I do a lot of work with Japanese companies as well. And I think that they see things in a much longer time frame than we do, because they don't have the same shareholder pressure, because a lot of the, you know, the big trading houses have been around for a very, very long time. But they, they're starting to wake up to it and really recognize that it's a competitive advantage to be investors that people want, investors that don't mess you over when they are in a geopolitical game with China, particularly around large infrastructure projects. So there's, I don't really care what your motive is, whether it's genuinely rooted in sound ethics, or whether it's commercially motivated, or whether it's enlightened self-interest, whatever you want to call it. If the net effect is better governance, I'm happy to help.
Yeah. However we get there is kind of irrelevant exactly. to you, right? It's such an interesting thing for me, because I think sometimes we in the West, or whatever, we in America can sometimes be a little bit Pollyannish about, well, just don't take the bribe. You know, it's like, well, you don't know what the reality of it is, when, to this woman's point, I think you were saying, in Cambodia, she has to bribe to get to the store, and she has to bribe to get her kid into class. Like, it's part of life. And I heard, or I think I read this story in Intentional Integrity, Rob Chestnut's book. And this, I think, was when they were over, when he was at eBay, and he was talking about, I'm going to mess the story up. This is generally accurate. Okay. But I think they were going into India, and, you know, again, to get the shipments in there, to get, you know, whatever, you had to kind of pay, you know, the commonplace business practices. You had to kind of grease the palms and, you know, do the bribes. And they just said, you know what, we're not doing them. And they went right to the government. And then the government, kind of to this ideal scenario you're kind of describing, they went to the government, and they kind of leaned on the government, and they were able to sort of change that, at least on some level, which is great and phenomenal. And I think if more companies did that, that would be awesome. Many companies, though, who are just trying to get, you know, they're maybe just, you know, in a burgeoning industry, or they're just kind of a small organization that's just starting to grow internationally. How much sway do they have to actually change things? And how, I don't know, maybe this is just kind of this moral dilemma, but like, and maybe it comes down to each person's integrity. I'd love to hear what you think, or what each organization's sort of overall integrity. But, you know, how do you say, we're not doing it now, and we're going to go to the government, and then the government's like, I don't know what Acme Anvil company is. You know what I'm saying? Like, how much sway do companies actually have, and how, you know, how can they justify kind of dying on that hill if it's so, you know, pervasive and so, you know what I'm saying? Like, just kind of rot it out to the core. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a fantastic observation, and it's absolutely spot on. And I think there's, you know, I try to break things down into simple steps, because I'm not as smart as some of the other people out there who can solve these really complicated problems. But I would always look at short, medium, and long term. And in the situations you mentioned, you're absolutely right. So I've worked with, I don't know, like a mega tech manufacturer going into Vietnam. So they were using Vietnam as their China plus one. And whenever they have a problem with the guy threatening to turn off the utilities or whatever funny business it is, they make a call, someone in Hanoi, the problem goes away. That access is reserved for very few people. There are some weird exceptions, like, for example, Nordic companies in the Mekong region, like Vietnam and in particular, and Lao, they have very heavy sway because they kept embassies there throughout the entirety of Vietnam's war with America and that kind of stuff. So, but those guys have channels and access. But aside from those idiosyncrasies, what I see people doing is a mixture of things. There's very active chambers of commerce in this region where people work through. There's industry working groups, like particularly, say, the healthcare sector. They are in this region, they're phenomenal at coming together. So Indonesia, for example, came up with a new reg where you have to report every single payment you make to a healthcare professional. But there was no real guidance about how you should be reporting it, that the agency you're meant to be reporting it to, which is the Independent Anti-Corruption Commission, doesn't have the capacity to be processing that. They're focused on big ticket prosecutions of sort of cabinet ministers. And so it was just not very well thought out in every possible way. So they then come together as a lobby. And one of the big observations I've made is, I've seen here is, the rule of law is not the same as you and I might have grown up with it in terms of a sort of a case law system, but also one where there's sort of precedent. So a lot of these countries have colonial and also other troubled overlays. So, you know, Cambodia, you have a mixture of French Napoleonic law with Khmer Rouge law, now sort of American aid-sponsored law, and it's chaotic. So what you have to do is you go to the enforcer, because you can't always interpret what's on the page. So you go to the regulatory agency and say, what is it you need from me? And how do I actually comply with this? I need your help. So there's government relations and compliance often have a much closer relations here than maybe they might do in more established markets. So there's collective action, there's coming together, whether it be by industry, whether it be your national chamber of commerce, or obviously AmCham, the American chamber is very powerful in this region, in the different chapters. There's more informal links, like if you're together on a business park or if you're operating in the same area and you're having similar shakedown issues, you kind of come together. But ultimately, there's also a prioritization, and there has to be a bit of honesty, particularly around facilitation payments. So when I've worked with some clients who will say we are working towards zero tolerance, because if we implement zero tolerance tomorrow and cease all facilitation payments, our business will kind of fall over. So, and that speaks to your Acme Anvil corporation. So it's about, it's like, you know, you have kids, right? So you know, I imagine one of the things I always have to try and remember as a parent is you should be celebrating effort, not always achievement, because achievement may come more naturally to some people than others. So, and if you celebrate that achievement too much at the detriment of effort, it can be demoralizing. So we need to be celebrating people making effort. So if you are tiny, but you are doing everything you possibly can to affect change, more power to you.
It's a nice framework, actually. I guess at risk of, like, you know, boiling this all down, you know, there's kind of a common thread through this, or at least I've seen on a couple of things we've talked about, you know, on your risk assessments, we don't want this binary thing. And I think many, many times in compliance, we bring this sort of binary lawyer mind to it. You know, is this on this side of the line, or is it on that side of the line? And what we're really talking about is sort of more of a gradation and more of a spectrum in the approach of risk assessments. And I think if we can have that same kind of, elasticity of thought, I don't know what the right word is, but if we can apply that also to your point, efforts, then we can zoom out and sort of put aside the binary, like, okay, are you taking facilitation payments or not? And look more at, okay, well, what are you doing to take less, you know, take fewer of these facilitation payments? Or what kind of things are you doing, whether it's working with other organizations or other government agencies to help, you know, try to make things better? If we can shift towards that, not only does it maybe help spur on the type of change that we're trying to drive, but at the same time, we can recognize some successes along the way that also can kind of have that sort of positive knock-on effect as well, you know?
Yeah, it's also that I think one of the things that often gets forgotten in compliance is we need to be thinking about motive and rationalization. Often there's a fixation on controls, on controlling the opportunity side of the sort of the fraud triangle, if you like. And so and that's both the obviously for internal purposes, but also when you're looking at those external who may cause those issues, what is driving it? So some of the examples you gave, like getting your goods through customs, often the way that works is the grease money is going up a chain. It's not that guy who's getting it. It's like a sort of almost organized criminal network. He has to make payments to keep his job to people in that network. So you sometimes need to understand where he sits in a kind of Maslow's hierarchy. And I'm sorry, I'm saying he, but often those guys are he's, but where they sit in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs basis. So that there's, if I give one story that I love about how you also are thinking laterally and harnessing the power from within your organization. So I was working with a Danish organization that was in Thailand. This is a few years back, and they were getting this negative publicity in the media that come out of nowhere. They were getting thugs turning up at the gates of their facility. They had a deputy minister who was threatening to revise their license such that it would basically be unfeasible to continue. This was their most profitable enterprise in Asia. And they were worried. They were like, you know, what's going on? The port authority was also on their case. And so my job was to kind of look at, what was going on here? Is this coordinated? And how can we respond to this in an ethical way? And I went into the office of the country manager for Thailand, and he had, everyone like the fourth or fifth floor, and he had these bolts on the windows. And I thought, that's unusual. And he goes, oh, that's something I learned in Korea back in the day when, you know, I had to make some redundancies, and my assistant told me to get bolts on the window because they'd try and chuck me out the window. And they did try and chuck me out, but when they couldn't open the window, they weren't able to. So he said, so we need to harness that kind of local knowledge here. And so we started sort of working that local network. And what we uncovered was that the media stories were plants. You can bung journalists to print anything. And there was a fake NGO involved that was connected to the thugs. The deputy transport minister was on his last legs. He wasn't going to win the next term. So he was trying to extort money to buy votes or maybe to give himself a nice retirement. And the port authority was the only one who were just kind of going along with it, but they were also the most crucial stakeholder. And they campaigned on a Go Green initiative to get elected because they're an elected body. So the solution this country manager came up with was, well, we have a Go Green initiative as well. So if we turn all of our cranes from diesel to electric, we invite the port authority down. We tell them to take the photo opportunity, take the credit. It's going to help their re-election on the proviso that they make a lot of this go away and stop shaking us down. We just weather the storm with that deputy minister because he's not going to be around for much longer and he's probably going to go into easier marks, easier targets. And that worked out really well for them. And so that kind of lateral thought is phenomenal because it's considering motive. And I think in the when you're dealing with people trying to subvert your system, sometimes people are taking it a bit too personally. They're sort of assuming, you know, that it's natural, you know, that how dare they sort of request a bribe, or we should just say no, it's outrageous. Take a step back, you know, calm down and go, why is this person? Who is this person? Who are they connected to? What's the story here? Then we can respond in a more intelligent way.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's kind of a Western thing. I don't know. But just to kind of think, well, it's all about me. They're kind of coming for me. Well, you're just kind of there. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it was somebody else there, they would have been doing the same, putting those same pressures on to fund the retirement or to buy the votes or whatever.
Yeah.
Why is that so hard for people to zoom out of that, that sort of self-focus and look more? I mean, because to kind of consider motive is kind of like you need to be a little empathetic to put yourself in that shoe, or at least to look at it through that lens.
I think it's because you need to speak to someone much more smart than me, but from what I can see from my layman's perspective is we in the West put ourselves under way too much pressure. And so the point you made is phenomenal. It's a triggered, you're absolutely right. The what I saw in the days when we could travel was issue discovered in somewhere in Asia, someone from Europe or the States flies in, they bring a whole team, they chuck a lot of resources at the problem, they identify those involved, they fire people, they implement some measures and they're gone. And that, I understand the logic to that, but it can have some pretty horrific repercussions. I saw one instance, for example, in Malaysia where they acted too quickly without checking that the suppliers they terminated were connected to triads, and then the country manager's wife was beaten to a pulp on her way back from the school run. So, you know, these countries aren't as, you know, as predictable as you might imagine. And that's why I found it so interesting working with the Japanese, because they don't have the same reporting pressures that you guys do as well. They don't have to disclose to any regulator that or the shareholders that they've got an ongoing investigation into possible fraud or corruption. So that they're certainly operating under less pressure, let's put it that way. And so to give one example, I around about the same time as that fly in, fly out Malaysia one that went really wrong, I was working on another one for a Japanese organization. And they invited me up to Tokyo, and I went up to Tokyo and I went to this meeting. And then they said, we've discovered that we've got some quite significant government payment, you know, corruption, facilitation payment stuff in one Southeast Asian country. Is this common? And we talked through the parties involved. It was Thailand, it was a forestry ministry. I was like, yeah, it's pretty common in this region, da da da. And then they said, okay. I said, well, what do you want to do about it? And they said, nothing yet. and come back in 6 months. So I came back in 6 months and they said, well, we have 11 other subsidiaries in Southeast Asia. So we asked them if they were having that same issue. 9 of them said that they have the same issue. I was like, wow, do you want to do something now? They go, no, come back in 6 months. So I came back another 6 months, and obviously I'm slightly embellishing the story, but it was a long time. And they said, well, if we're having that issue, then what else were we having? So we broadened the net and they went really far. They went down to like health and safety stuff. Do we have a culture where people are drinking and getting on forklift trucks? Do we have harassment problems? And they took a really holistic look at essentially the extent of the rot in these subsidiary businesses. And then once they fully understood the picture and where the similarities, where there's overlap, then they were like, okay, we're going to bring something to bear that actually treats some of these symptoms in a sustained, systemic way. And it's going to be a 5-year program. That can't really happen with the shareholder pressure that most firms have in the West, in the current system. So people are almost incentivized to just act, fire, you know, fire first, ready, think later.
Ready, fire, aim type of thing. Fire, maybe you never aim. That is so interesting. You know, I mean, it all kind of comes down to the fuel, right? The fuel that's fueling the decisions. And if you have, to your point, if, you know, shareholder value is the thing and the quarterly numbers that the analysts, you know, anchor to that determine your stock price and your pension and all the shareholder, you know, dollars and wealth, if that's driving it, then it doesn't afford, to your point, the time to perhaps put a more holistic solution in place that can actually, like if you're weeding a garden, the worst thing you can do is start pulling up weeds and not getting the root. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it takes time and it takes more effort to like dig down and get those roots out. It's just so interesting in that story that they were like, okay, well, let's see some more. And really trying to get a clear picture of what this thing is. And then the response is a 5-year response. I mean, yeah. I'm like a long-term focus guy. I think that's like the way to run a business and so forth. And it's just so interesting that these different jurisdictions, like obviously the cultures are very different. They're very much alike in many ways or complementary in many ways, you know, this sort of West and this Japanese approach, but just that foundation, that long-term focus foundation affords so much more budget, so to speak, to actually get at the issue.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I've been learning Japanese for a while. I'm still fairly hopeless, but I really remember being in one of the meetings and I was sort of picking up what, you know, some of the words and I thought I was following it. And they use a lot of borrow words from English, as you probably know. And so I remember when there was da da da, and then the guy said, drink driving. And I was like, we're on drink driving? You know, I've become a convert, honestly, because I did one very large project for a Japanese company, benchmark, I think it's like 14 of their subsidiaries, risk assessment stuff. And they wanted to check a hypothesis because so they define harassment in two terms, power harassment, which we might call like workplace bullying, and sexual harassment. And they wanted to see if they could use that as the best indicator of the general health of their ethical, moral compliance framework. And it was fascinating. I mean, fascinating is probably the wrong word. I don't mean to sound glib, but in operations where you have those problems, there was a direct correlation with the full gamut of everything else, because you know it's pretty self-explanatory. You have a toxic culture where people at the top are acting with impunity and people at the bottom probably feel pretty awful, so they're not exactly motivated to either safeguard the company's interests or not defraud it. And so I don't want to sort of paint it in a rose-tinted light. You know, I have a lot of Japanese friends, and particularly the women still battle against institutional misogyny and glass ceilings. So it's not some sort of paradise of compliance awakening. The point of departure that I've seen, and it's a small sample for these large organizations, is a much more holistic one than I've seen anyone else use. And that is fascinating.
Yeah, they are by no means perfect, as there is no perfect culture or company or country, but they at least, there are elements of their approach or their way that they view the world that are conducive to, you know, a more holistic weeding of the garden or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Back to this, I find it interesting, that distinction between sort of power harassment and sexual harassment.
Yeah.
What is your thought about that? Is that an effective way to look at stuff?
I think it, again, it goes back to what we were discussing at the beginning and your comment, which is you have to make it culturally relevant. And unfortunately, in their culture, and it's not unique to their culture, in my culture of origin, the English culture, the kind of drinking culture, some of the objectifying and the treatment of women means that sort of, I mean, to put it crudely, like pervy men being gross is a problem in their culture, like it is in mine. So it does make sense, I think, to have that distinction, because power harassment is more of a structure of the hierarchy that exists in their organizations, where the, I mean, I know you read the book by Aaron Meyer, and I did as well. And so it's by far, it's dangerous to simplify, because as you know, it's a very two-way flow of information between top. It's not just top down, which everyone assumes it to be because of the sort of, you know, the bowing and the honorifics and stuff. But that said, if a boss shouts at you in public, that's not unfortunately uncommon. So the abuse, and I remember being in one training session where Japanese guys were giving it to a mixed group of Japanese and Singaporeans, and some of the examples I found interesting, because they were talking about when and where it's acceptable to raise your voice. So this was a manufacturing company, and they were saying, for example, if someone's reversing on the shop floor in some sort of forklift, you can yell at them if they're about to hit someone or something. That's acceptable. I was like, wow, okay, so you're going into that level of prescriptive. But then when they were talking about sexual harassment, I remember the term elevator eyes. They're like, you know, it was getting down to, again, a very prescriptive approach. Don't be doing, you know, the scanning up and down. So it's not for me to judge whether it's effective or not, because I'm not from that culture. And much as I love that country and I've tried to learn about it, I haven't grown up there. I sure as hell haven't grown up there as a minority or a female. So from my outside point of view, it makes sense that for that culture, they have that distinction.
Got it. Do you think broadly, like, one occurs without the other? Like, does one always drag along the other, or are they correlated, or do you ever see, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's a great point.
It may, I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting line to draw, because I just always thought of it as kind of one thing, and it's not one thing, perhaps, because there's this cultural element where maybe the hierarchy is, I don't know, it's all these different shades of gray, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's so many ways you could take that. Just thinking out loud, if you're talking about say a mining operation where it's heavily male dominated, I do think maybe having that distinction of the power harassment is helpful, because if you just clump it, just take away power or sexual and call it harassment, I think, sometimes there might be the expectation, oh, you just deal with it. That's, you know, the way things are done. It's a rough and tumble type of culture where it's a man's job, all that kind of rubbish. So by defining it as power harassment, somebody abusing their position of power, I think is actually probably quite helpful. Whether the two are symbiotic, I suspect they often are, but they're always going to be exceptions. They're always going to be, I don't know, weak managers that aren't interested in shouting at their employees, but they're very interested in inviting female employees to inappropriate offsite reviews or whatever. So yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either. It is interesting to kind of consider, or it's at least kind of eye opening for me. What about when you're helping, like, do you ever help them, like, when they go to the West? Like, are you ever working with an Asian country and you're going, and now you're doing a risk assessment on their, like, Western subsidiary or something? And, like, what is that like?
It's hilarious. I really love it, because, when I worked in the UK, I was covering EMEA, and the majority of the fraud investigations I did certainly were in the UK. There's this perception that I now work in an area where I do a lot of work in Australia, and they also have a lot of issues. There's this perception that somehow we in the West have managed to kid people into thinking that we are having it more together. I mean, that's unfurling pretty spectacularly at the moment. I mean, your country and my country are doing their very best to dispel that in a pretty seismic way. But so there, on the one hand, there is I remember like a media guy from Korea describing one of the UK cities as like a scene from Braveheart when he went out on a Friday night. And he said, I did not realize. And another comment that I loved was somebody, it's the little comments I love, was somebody flying back again from Korea to the UK and saying, why are there so many people who clearly do no exercise wearing active wear? And that's a comment that you can make in an Asian setting and it not be offensive. And I was like, you can't say that, you know, because again, we have different sensibilities. Like it's, when I was learning Chinese, I really had to deal with that. My teacher would say to me, like in Chinese, you have a big nose. And I'd be like, okay.
Can't do anything about that, bud.
Yeah, I can't, that's the way it is. And she goes, no, you know, you can be direct with me too. I was like, wow. And she goes, well, you know, you can say I've got small eyes if you think that. And I was like, I'm not going to say that, but you know, thanks for, and so you, when, you know, cause I'm now married into an Asian family, when you sort of have, we've got Lunar New Year coming up, you will have people come up to you and go, oh yeah, you've been eating well. You look a bit more, you know, and yeah. So that there's so sometimes the resetting the offense on meta, cause we all take offense at different things is one thing. It's interesting, but getting back to more serious stuff, I think, it's what you touched on earlier. It's individualism versus collectivism often is an interesting one to straddle. So there's another book called The Geography of Thought, which, I mean, it's a little bit, reads a little bit like a kind of a colonial kind of examination of two different cultures. So it is with its limits, but the central theory posited is that Asian cultures grew, if you look back to sort of the agri economy, it was rice. That's a communal crop. Everyone has to come together to grow it. It's the water is a communal resource that has to be rooted across it. The West made its money on big flat fields where you just chuck some seed and hope for rain. And so that's a much more individualistic and a risk-taking approach in some ways. So that then can impact in a certain degree the cultural, and of course there are lots of exceptions, but that would be one of the bigger observations I'd make about, particularly if you've got an Asian company acquiring a Northern European, Anglo-Saxon, or North American company, having to deal with the fact that everyone thinks that they have a right to be heard and that their opinion matters. And that's something we take, I guess, to a certain extent for granted, but that isn't always, you know, there's more of the tall poppy syndrome in some settings in some cultures in this region. So that's an interesting one.
Yeah, that is an interesting one. That's an interesting thing to flip. Yeah, they acquire something in the West and they're like, I don't really care what you have to say. Do what I'm telling you to do. You know what I'm saying? That's an interesting thing to flip. And that sort of agrarian sort of root and what those, how interesting is that? If that's actually true, it may be true. It's at least, it's at least a kind of cohesive story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. And there's other psychological studies. I mean, I went back to do behavioral psychology, sort of postgrad studies about 5-6 years ago, focusing on deception detection and micro expressions, all that cool stuff.
Oh, cool.
But one of the things that was very revealing in that is an examination of your own culture and your own biases. And because you bring those into an interview setting when you're trying to detect the emotions in others and the way you construct and construe emotions that you observe in others. And there's other observations around like when you show like, there's one experiment, and I'm probably getting it wrong, but a Japanese students and American students were shown one of those paintings of the carp pond, you know, the very common Chinese-Japanese painting you'll see with lots of fish. And asked to describe it, the Americans will pick generally the big fish, talk about that most. The Japanese would talk about the sort of the entirety of it. So there are, you know, cliches. My wife always says cliches exist for a reason. She's Singaporean, but she did a secondary education in the States. So she worked a lot in the UK. So she's sort of lived in both cultures as well. And so there is often a grain of truth in some of these cliches. Sure. It's honestly, it's the whole cultural dynamic is fascinating.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Let me ask you this. When you're diving in or you're coming into another country, many times you're probably dealing with sort of native, people who are from that country, and you're dealing with some expats as well. Mm. What are the different sort of phases of resistance you're met with from those different groups? And are there kind of consistencies across kind of the expats? I always have to kind of overcome this thing. And, you know, the people who are from that country, I always have to kind of come this angle. Is there any kind of takeaways that you've boiled down from your experiences?
That's a really interesting question. Yeah, there's, as generalization, the expat resistance will often be the, you know, that it's been done this way, but it's coming. If you look at the motive, it's how am I going to hit my targets and get secure my next move and my next promotion if I'm also meant to do it in a compliant fashion. So you have to sell them on the fact that actually this can be, well, many could be many things. This is actually, if you clean up this business, it's going to be a good career feather in your cap, or let's help you address which parts of this submarket are actually possible for you to operate in cleanly. So don't like be tendering for construction contracts for the Ministry of Defense in Thailand, go instead for private hospitals. You know, so that it's sometimes using some lateral thought. But the with the people, the local people in the countries, I think the resistance I encounter is often that they are the ones who are going to have to enact it. And it's particularly when you're talking about smaller communities, they know a lot of these people, they might be connected. You have some village elders and those systems that you're asking them to disrupt. And often they've had these tasks delegated to them because the expats either can't speak the language, don't understand the culture, won't roll up their sleeves and do it. And so they're reluctantly going into quite hostile situations. So to give one example, as a lady in I work with in Indonesia, and she was so Indonesia is the chaotic in terms of a lot of the licensing. So to process an expat visa, which is called a work visa, called a Kitas, there's a 9 different agencies involved across 11 stop process. So there is there's a lot of hands that come out. And so she's in charge of getting a Kitas for a new expat in that country. She's repeatedly dealing with police and other agencies who are not respectful of her as a young woman. They're bordering on harassing. And so that I come in under the auspices of sort of ethics and compliance, but what I feel like sometimes is, and I say I like working with other people because you can never do this alone. You need to have people with complementary skills. But what we feel like is a sort of a counselor, change manager, crisis responder. It, depending on the situation, often the ethics and compliance goal is achieved via non-traditional methods that are much more human, like the examples I gave with the Thailand Go Green initiative. That's not a compliance solution. That's a logical human meets.
It's clever. A human solution. Yeah. It's a sort of, as you called it, sort of lateral thinking. It's sort of strategic. I don't know. It's not the sort of myopic, one-dimensional kind of just ethics thing. We're trying to solve a problem in an ethical way. So you're what, 10 hours ahead of us? No, they're like 12 or 13 hours ahead of me. So you're already in the future. Look a little further in the future. What is compliance and ethics going to look like 10 years from now?
And that's that one I've tried to answer a number of times because I've been asked it, and I still haven't come up with something that I'm completely happy with. But I think obviously we know technology, so let's take that off the table. Technology will continue to evolve and disrupt, and particularly around the way we educate each other and mobile apps and gamification and all of those topics that are certainly they're already here, they're going to increase. I think the other area is also already happening. It's the acceleration of recognition that the compliance straddles more than it traditionally has. There's elements of environmental and social governance that are also coming into play in the sort of the ESG agenda, but more broadly, just the recognition that ethics is about anything that has positive or deleterious impacts on society and stakeholders within and external to an organization. I think the other areas, I think it's it will start to become something more measurable and something to be proud of. I don't know what it's like in the States, but here when there's a lot of construction and a lot of construction sites you drive past, they will have like proudly displayed how many hours they've gone accident-free, that type of stuff. And yeah. So I remember working for a construction company in Indonesia, and the boss there was amazing. So they had real problems, the real corruption problems. And he came in on day one of the time we were there doing these risk storms and risk assessments and stuff. And the team had gathered around, and he said, I'm going to spend, I've blocked out the next 2-3 days. I'm going to solve every one of these problems with you. As engineers, we have a culture, bring me solutions, don't bring me problems. These problems we need to share together. And it's vital we do. 20 years ago, you guys all came to me saying that all this health and safety regulation was going to kill our business. You're now coming to me saying all this compliance regulation is going to kill our business. We're still here. We're still going to be here in 20 years, and we're going to be the guys with the best, you know, compliance. We have the best health and safety now. That's why we win a lot of bids. We have a prestigious right. sort of client book.
It's an asset. So I had to
actually genuine, marketable, measurable, demonstrable asset.
I love it. You know, as I'm listening to you, I am like, this is totally fascinating conversation. And what is interesting is like, you're on the frontier of this. You have to pull out all the, I don't know, you have to pull out all the tricks. You have to have a full toolbox of behavioral science and salesmanship and, you know, translation of sort of policies into actual behavior changes. Cause you're kind of navigating these different cultures and these different hierarchies and all these different things. It's like, there's so much that could be borrowed from or learned. You know, people who are just in the States or just in, you know, the UK can learn so much from somebody like you who has to navigate through all this and thread all these needles. Because when we're talking about these different cultures, you know, these just kind of boil down, you know, all these differences in these different cultures exist at some level, and maybe they're smaller spectrums or whatever within our, you know, just domestic approach. So the way that you have to kind of get in there and empathize with somebody and get on their level and meet them where they're at and really understand the dynamics of what they're facing, you know, if we can do that in our own organizations, we can probably more quickly accelerate toward this kind of panacea where, you know, 1,000 days without a compliance incident is something that's up on the wall. Mm-hmm. And this thing becomes a, you know, an asset for the organization. And I'm also kind of struck by that analogy you drew between sort of health and safe, or, you know, kind of health and safety in the construction context as like what that resistance was. And now how there's a massive separation between organizations that like are safety first, they win the best bids, they can charge more and so forth. When again, 20 years ago, everyone was wringing their hands, nervous that, man, this is a bunch more cost. How are we going to stay alive? That same thing is a picture of, I think, what we're about to see right now. It's just I've learned so much from this conversation, man. This has been really a lot of fun.
Well, likewise, and thank you. I mean, I agree. I mean, I'm a repository for other people's bright ideas often. One of the things I'm very conscious of is that I often have imposter syndrome. I don't have the credentials a lot of the clients do. I don't have a law degree. I'm not an accountant. I'm, you know, just this kind of investigator that likes finding stuff out who's fallen into this thing. But it is telling the stories of the people on the front line and it is a vital. Just one data point that you can probably dig out, which is the Nordic Business Ethics Survey. One of them, it's a fascinating survey, and it's got a lot of data from across the Nordic region. The one thing that really struck me, and it's been my experience time and time again, is when they ask people in senior positions, and senior, I think they did it by age, but you can assume senior, 55 and above, yeah. How prevalent, you know, how many corruption incidents or fraud or whatever it was, are there in our organization? And it was a small percentage. Then they asked people below 30, and it was double or triple. And that's also a global phenomenon. And I think that's one thing I would like to do. And thank you very much for giving me this platform, is to get access to some of the folks who are in those head office functions and help them understand and work with their people in the front lines who are dealing with these pain points. Because when I hear people go, oh, we've got zero tolerance in Europe or in the States, and I see that they have operations in places like Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia, I'm like, you don't. Yeah, I'm sorry, you don't.
Right.
But someone's not telling you something, and it's possibly because they're scared. And if it's to work, we can't have scared people. We need to have, you know, your post today, we need to have like love, compassion, empathy, and honesty for people. There needs to be a recognition that, you know, somebody is not evil if they under extortive, harassing pressure, make a payment to an Indonesian police officer.
Yeah, was that woman an evil parent to get her kids paper graded?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Yeah.
How can people find you, man? How can they learn more about you and your work and your impact?
LinkedIn, I guess, is where I'm most active. I have the other socials, but LinkedIn is the one I'm most active on. And then the company is Ethics Insight. And so it's ethicsinsight.co, not .com. You can find more information there. And I guess those are the two main places.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Ethics Experts, man. This was a freaking eye-opening conversation. Really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for giving me the time. And sorry if I gave you some pretty long answers there.
No, I love a long answer. So I appreciate you, man.
We'll see you soon.